If you rely on engineered materials, and we all do, whether it's the steel in a skyscraper or just a simple metal built in your car, you're depending on its strength. We design these things to handle incredible stress. But then sometimes you see these catastrophic failures. A structure that should be indestructible just snaps.
Right.
And the culprit is usually this hidden microscopic flaw in how even strong materials actually break.
But that's really the core conflict in material science. I mean, the fracture of metals is, it's probably the single most important practical thing in engineering today.
Especially for big structures.
Exactly. We have to understand not just if a metal will fail, but how and why it sometimes fails so suddenly with basically no warning at all.
And when we talk about failure, there are really two main ways it can happen, right? There's the kind that gives you a heads up, and then the kind that just happens.
That's a great way to put it. The predictable kind is what we call ductile fracture. It happens slowly. You get a lot of plastic deformation. Think of a metal bar stretching, getting thinner. It gives you all these visual cues that it's about to go.
And the other kind.
That's brittle fracture, often called cleavage. And that is sudden. It happens along these specific atomic planes with almost no warning, no deformation you can see.
And that sudden snap, that's the real mystery.
It's been the enduring paradox for decades. And that's really the mission for this deep dive. We're going back to some foundational research, a really landmark 1953 paper by G.W. Greenwood, all about this mechanism of cleavage.
So the core question we're trying to tackle is, how can something so strong be so weak?
It sounds absurd, doesn't it? But that's it. We need to understand why metals cleave, why they break at stress levels that are 100, sometimes 1,000 times lower than what theory says they should hold.
1,000 times. So you design something to hold 1,000 tons, and it snaps at 10.
That's the staggering discrepancy we need to resolve.
Okay, let's unpack that. Where did those huge theoretical numbers even come from? What were scientists calculating in the first place?
They were calculating what's called the theoretical tensile strength. We can call it sigma.
Right.
And the idea came from imagining a perfect crystal, just a flawless lattice of atoms. The calculation is basically, what's the maximum force you need to pull two of those atomic planes apart all at once?
So you're looking at the bonds between individual atoms and figuring out the force to break them all simultaneously.
Exactly. And you end up with this gigantic, idealized number for the material's strength.
But of course, when they actually tested real materials, even something very crystalline like rock salt, the actual stress, the sigma, it was just nowhere near that.
Not even close. Orders of magnitude weaker. And that realization back in the early 20th century, it kicked off this huge effort to figure out what was going on.
So they had two possibilities. Either the calculation was just wrong, or the material wasn't as perfect as they were imagining.
Precisely. And one of the first paths they went down was what they called thermodynamic theories.
Okay, what was the thinking there?
Well, people like Firth, they tried to explain it with energy balance. They basically said, a fracture will happen when the elastic energy you get back from the material stretching is enough to create the two new surfaces of the crack.
That makes sense. An energy trade-off.
Yeah.
But why did that idea fail?
Because it was built on a really flawed assumption. It assumed the fracture happened with zero plastic deformation.
So they thought it just snapped cleanly like glass.
Right. But every single experiment, even on metals that looked super brittle, showed that there was always a tiny bit of local plastic flow right near the fracture surface. And that meant the theory was just, it was contradicted by reality.
So the material was bending and flowing on a micro level, and those theories just couldn't account for that energy being absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where it gets interesting, because the next big leap forward didn't come from metals at all. It came from glass.
That's right. The huge pivot point was in 1920 with the Griffith theory. Griffith was the one who said, you can't assume the material is perfect. He explained the low strength of glass by saying it must have tiny pre-existing internal cracks.
Ah, so if the material already has a tiny flaw, like a microscopic knife cut inside it?
The stress gets magnified right at the tip of that cut. Griffith's idea was that this crack would grow on its own, spontaneously, but only if the energy released by the material relaxing around it was more than the energy needed to create the new surfaces of the growing crack.
And that worked perfectly for glass. But we already said metals aren't like glass. They flow a little. How do they adapt that theory?
That needed the Orowan modification, which came later in the 40s. Orowan realized that for a crack to move through a metal, the metal right at the crack tip had to deform plastically. It had to yield.
And that process must use up a ton of energy.
A massive amount, far more than just the energy to create new atomic surfaces. So Orwin added this big term, P, to the equation, which stands for the plastic work that's absorbed right at the crack tip.
So the crack has to fight its way through this tiny zone of yielding metal.
Precisely. And that explained crack propagation, why a crack keeps going once it starts. But it still didn't answer the first question. How does the crack even start? How does a low overall stress suddenly create that enormous local stress needed to break atomic bonds?
And this is the key. This leads us right to the aha moment, the dislocation theory.
This is where it all comes together. The theory, pioneered by people like Zener and Orwin, it shifted the focus from pre-existing cracks to stress concentration caused by defects inside the crystal.
Let's quickly define a dislocation, because it's so important here. It's not a crack, it's more like a slight misalignment in the atomic grid, right?
That's it, exactly. Imagine rows of atoms like books on a shelf. Mm-hmm. A dislocation is like an extra half row of books squeezed in, and when you apply stress, these defects can move, which is what allows the metal to deform plastically.
But they don't always move freely.
Correct, and this is the genius of the theory. The dislocations move, but then they get blocked. They pile up against some kind of barrier.
Like what kind of barrier?
It could be a grain boundary, where the crystal orientation suddenly changes, or maybe a hard impurity particle.
So you get this huge traffic jam of defects inside the metal, and they're all pushing forward.
And the force of all those piled up dislocations gets concentrated on an incredibly small spot. It's like a tiny, powerful wedge being driven into that grain boundary.
And that wedge action creates this massive local stress.
Hundreds of times magnified. Well, so even if the overall stress you're applying is low, the stress right at the head of that pileup can, just for an instant, get high enough to break the atomic bonds. It can exceed that theoretical strength, sigma.
And that's how the crack starts.
That is exactly how crack nucleation occurs. The theory finally explained how a theoretically strong material could be so practically weak. Its own internal structure creates these points of intense stress.
And what's really amazing is that both of these successful ideas, the modified Griffith theory for metals and this new dislocation theory, they both make a very specific, testable prediction.
They do. Both models predicted a clear relationship between the stress needed for cleavage, sigma, and the size of the internal features, like the grain diameter, which we'll call D.
And what was the prediction?
They predicted that the fracture stress should be inversely proportional to the square root of the grain diameter.
So to put that in practical terms for you, the listener, this means that if you have a metal with really large crystal grains, it's going to need a lot less stress to make it snap.
Right. And if you can make the grains really, really tiny, you make the material much, much tougher.
It's a nonlinear relationship. You get huge benefits from a fine internal structure.
And testing that prediction is exactly what Greenwood's 1953 research on pure polycrystalline zinc was all about.
Okay, so tell us about the zinc study. How did they set it up?
They used incredibly pure zinc, 99.99%, and they tested it in simple tension. But they did it across a massive temperature range.
From what to what?
From normal room temperature all the way down to liquid nitrogen, so minus 196 degrees Celsius. And crucially, they systematically changed the grain size in their samples to see how it affected everything.
And the results. Did the theory hold up? Did they find that square root relationship?
At the low temperatures, especially at minus 196 C and minus 77 C, the data was the smoking gun.
Really?
When they plotted the fracture stress they measured against one over the square root of the grain size, the data points fell on a perfect straight line, exactly as the theory predicted.
Wow. So that's powerful quantitative proof.
It was huge. It confirmed that this dislocation pileup mechanism is what initiates cracks in metals.
So the internal geometry is the key. Right. They also looked at other things, right? Like temperature and speed.
Yes, and they found a very clear link. Cleavage, or brittle fracture, is much more likely as you lower the temperature, and this is critical, as you increase the strain rate.
The speed you pull it at.
The speed you pull it at. If you pull it slowly, the dislocations have time to move around and relieve the stress. If you yank it fast, they pile up instantly and create that critical stress.
And they were able to quantify this relationship with something called activation energy. What does that tell us?
The amount of plastic strain that happens just before the metal cleaves. It followed a clear activation energy relationship. They calculated the energy, Q, to be about 21 kilocalories per gram molecule.
Okay, that's a very specific number. Why is that number so important?
Because 21 kcals isn't just a random number. For zinc, that value is already known to be associated with a fundamental process called self-diffusion.
which is how atoms just move around inside the crystal on their own.
Exactly. It's the energy needed for atoms to just randomly rearrange themselves because of heat.
So if the energy needed for fracture matches the energy for atoms to just move around, what does that imply?
It implies that brittle failure isn't just a static event. It's a thermally assisted kinetic process. The atoms are already trying to move, and the stress you apply just helps that process along, pushing it to the breaking point. It connects this catastrophic failure to the subtle, constant motion of the atoms.
That's profound. It completely changes how you think about it. So let's bring this back to the practical side for you listening. We talk about a transition temperature, the point where a material goes from safe and ductile to dangerous and brittle. How does grain size help us manage that?
Well, since we know that smaller grains make the material stronger, it means the material can withstand more stress before those dislocation pileups become critical.
Right.
So by refining the grain size, the experiment showed you actually lower that dangerous transition temperature. It means your material stays tough and ductile even at much colder temperatures. It's a fundamental way to make things safer.
So we have this beautiful theory, and it's powerfully confirmed with the zinc, but good science always needs a counterexample. And Greenwood's work included one. Magnesium.
Yes, pure polycrystalline magnesium. And they chose it because on the surface, it's very similar to zinc. It has the same hexagonal, close-packed crystal structure.
So you'd expect similar results.
You might think so, but material science is rarely that simple.
This is the twist in the story.
It's a huge divergence. The results for magnesium, and I'm quoting here, were markedly different. It showed incredible ductility. It just kept stretching and flowing, even at minus 196 C.
So it didn't become brittle at all?
Not in the same way. And critically, its fracture stress showed no clear link to grain size or temperature or strain rate. It just didn't exhibit those low cleavage stresses that made zinc so interesting. It was just intrinsically tougher.
So after proving this whole mechanism with zinc, magnesium comes along and just ignores the rules.
Right.
If they have the same crystal type, why was it so much tougher? What was the subtle difference?
It shows just how complex this is. While they're both hexagonal, the precise geometry is different. Magnesium has a slightly different axial ratio, but more importantly, its atomic structure allows for more slip systems to be active.
More? Escape routes for the dislocations.
That's a perfect way to think of it. More planes for plastic flow to happen easily, even when it's cold. So when dislocations start to pile up, they have other ways to go, other paths to take to relieve the stress.
So they never build up that critical wedge of force needed to start a crack.
Exactly. Magnesium structure is intrinsically better at relieving stress through flow, while zinc structure tends to channel that stress into making a crack. It showed the theory was right, but needed more detail to account for these nuances.
So this deep dive has really walked us through a genuine scientific breakthrough. The main takeaway is that the zinc data showing that fracture stress depends on the inverse square root of grain diameter. That provided powerful, undeniable support for the dislocation pileup theory.
That's the cornerstone. It solved the great paradox. It showed us that strong metals are practically weak because of the way their own internal defects can magnify small external forces into huge internal ones.
We pinpointed the mechanism. So where does that leave us for the future of designing materials? If we know how the cracks start, what's the ultimate goal?
Well, the research showed that things like impurities and pre-straining the metal could affect the cleavage stress. And then you have magnesium, which shows that some structures are just naturally resistant.
Right.
So the next frontier isn't just about managing the external stress on a part or avoiding low temperatures. It's about proactive control. The real challenge is figuring out how to manipulate the crystal structure itself.
You mean managing the defects, adding certain alloys?
Yes, using thermal treatments, doing whatever it takes to fundamentally eliminate the possibility of cleavage failure in the first place. The focus shifts from just avoiding damage to actually controlling the internal architecture of the material to make it impossible. That remains the ultimate goal in fracture mechanics,